Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's February 2nd. It's Monday, and why is this a noteworthy week? Oh, because you do have a test next week. Yeah, so this is like last preparation for the test coming up. But it's also, don't forget, disaster drill week. It's disaster drill. So you have to, the instructors have to know who's in class, who's not in class. In case the building falls down, we know to recover somebody, right? So it's the responsibility of all instructors to know who's in class. So here's your sign-in sheet, but you should sign this anyway, right? So I'll pass that around. Make sure you sign in. And if there is a disaster drill, you proceed where? Through a safe exit, right? Preferably not one that is falling down or in flames. And proceed to the parking lot, huh? Calmly, that's right. And of course, you should take all your belongings with you because you never know if you'll ever be able to get back in the room again. So take all your belongings with you, and then if I don't have the lights on, make sure I turn the lights on so you don't fall down the stairs, and then follow instructions in the parking lot, and hopefully it won't be raining when we exit the building safely and calmly. Okay? All right, so that might happen. Who knows? We just never know when that's going to happen. The other thing is, we're scheduled to have a test 1 week from today, and we'll see how that goes. If we have a disaster drill, there's no way that we'll be ready for that test on Monday, but other than that, maybe we're looking okay. I'm not sure. So I think I'm going to kind of shut up and get talking about the lecture. Oh, I do have another comment, and that is in lab. I've walked by labs, and they look kind of empty toward the end of class. And that's really good study time for you guys to network and quiz each other on the web questions. And you can say, draw this out and draw that out and work with each other. And in particular, those quantitative questions, you have about 3 questions at the end of every chapter. I know some of you don't have very good quantitative skills. That's a really good time to ask your lab instructor, oh, show me how to set this equation up or set this, how do we set up this to get the correct solution to that question. So, I mean, you got to take advantage of that time, right? So don't just get your lab work done and skedaddle. You should be working your lab instructors to death in there, all right, so that you're prepared for the test coming up. Yeah?
Please,
come on up. For the next test coming up?
Yeah.
Is this a good one? That's a good one.
Okay.
Juan Wei. So we'll put the building number down. Okay, so the lecture notes for Chapter 6 are up, and also the study guide for Chapter 6 is online. And tonight I'll put the one lecture from last week online, and this one too. So remember, I didn't have the recorder last Monday, so that one didn't get up. I was just so busy over the weekend getting that study guide and the lectures redone. See, it really is a pain when you change textbooks from one edition to another. It's something I didn't really want to do. All right, so Juan Wei, Tuesdays, Thursdays, 1:30 to 3 p.m., business building on the third floor. So if you want to go do some collaborative learning techniques, that would be a good time for you to do that. Okay. Yeah, every Tuesday and every Thursday. So that's Tuesday and that's Thursday. Okay. And I don't know if he came and spoke to this class, but people that you routinely go to SI, the statistics show that they typically do one letter grade better if they consistently go to SI. So if you're on a plateau and you're getting like a mid-level B, if you go routinely to SI, you're probably going to crack that A barrier. So it's worth going if you have time to do that, right? Okay. All right, so how are the lights, okay? Too bright? You can see the screen, okay? All right, so we were talking about mitosis last time. And guess what I have on the board right here? Yeah, I have a cell, right? And it's dividing into two other cells right over here. I think I had this on the board last time. And so what's the name of that process? That could be maybe, well, there's only two cells right here, so this is mitosis. This is mitosis. How many chromosomes are in this cell?
41.
Yeah, 46. Remember, they're in two sets, like this. So there's 23 in this set, 23 in this set. One's a paternal set, one's a maternal set. So this is what we call the parent cell. And after mitosis, you end up with, 46 chromosomes again, here and here. So these cells are identical. What do we call these cells again? These are daughter cells. These are daughter cells. They're identical. You could think of them as clones of each other. And the daughter cells are identical to the parent cell. There should be no change in the information. If there is, then that's a bad thing. All right, so what are the two reasons for mitosis? Growth and replacement of old and damaged cells, right? At one time, you were just a single cell. You couldn't come and take physiology notes if you were just a single cell. So growth is a reason for mitosis. Plus, all the cells in your body aren't the same ones that you had 20 years ago. Right? Some of those had to be replaced. So if you start with a parent cell with 46 chromosomes and you end up with two daughter cells with 46 chromosomes, how come it's the same number? What do you have to do before this parent cell splits into two? You've got to replicate the chromosomes. Right, we don't say duplicate, it's a duplication process, but we call it replication, DNA replication. Remember, there's a DNA polymerase that makes a second strand of DNA or a second chromosome. So here's a chromosome that has not been replicated. What does it look like when it is replicated? Yeah, it has an extra loop right here, so instead of a bow tie, it's what? It's a double bow tie, kind of looks like that. And these two chromosomes are connected right at the centromere, right? All right, so now this is a replicated chromosome. They're identical, but they're different. They're just attached right here. So what do we call these different replicated chromosomes? Yeah, as a matter of fact, these are called sister chromatids. Okay, so DNA replication has to take place first. All right, so mitosis have these phases right here. You learned all this in anatomy and how to talk about the phases and what's happening during these different phases. So I don't think I'm going to belabor many of these points right here, but you should be able to recognize that this is prophase because the chromatin has condensed. You can see some chromosomes. You see the nuclear envelope is disappearing. Right, and you can see that the centrosomes are splitting and going to opposite poles of the cell on this illustration. So that's pretty much what's happening during prophase. And here, this is interphase because I see chromatin all extended. I don't see any chromosomes right here, so the chromatin is extended. And the chromatin is being used. All right, and then here is the easiest stage to see, or phase of mitosis. That is metaphase, chromosomes all lined up at the equator of the cell, and then the chromosomes start to separate. So what is separating right here? What would you say? Yeah, the sister chromatids are being pulled apart, right? And they're just hopping a ride on the spindle apparatus. They're being pulled to either end of the cell, and then finally and lastly, the chromatids are pulled tight up against the centrosomes, and a cleavage furrow is developing. This process that separates the cytoplasm into two daughter cells via this cleavage furrow right here, which happens during telophase, is called, somebody almost said it, cytokinesis, right? So in this class, you should just automatically always say that cytokinesis takes place during telophase. Depending on the cell and depending on other kinds of research activities, some people might say that cytokinesis maybe happens after telophase or before telophase, and maybe people will be talking about that for 100 years, but you've got to take a test well before that 100 years is up. So we'll just define it in here that cytokinesis happens during telophase. Right. Okay. Now make sure if your lab instructor has a different idea, make sure that you're in sync with your lab instructor. Okay, so here is another organelle. This one is interesting because it is not membrane-bound. Membrane-bound, an organelle that's membrane-bound means that it just has a membrane around it. That's all that means. So who could give me an example of an organelle that is membrane-bound?
Mitochondria.
Mitochondria, right. As a matter of fact, it has a double membrane. There's an inner and an outer membrane. And how would you describe that membrane? How would you describe any kind of membrane you see in the cell? It's a phospholipid bilayer, right? And then furthermore, you could dissolve other kinds of proteins in it. More sophisticated model in your mind would be the fluid mosaic model, but the basic nature is a phospholipid bilayer. These centrioles here and here don't have any kind of membrane structure. They're made up of microtubules, and if you put two of these centrioles together, that's a centrosome, and the job of a centrosome is to organize all of the microtubules and microfilaments inside the cell, right? And it kind of acts as just an anchor for all the microfilaments and microtubules inside the cell. And don't forget, those define the shape of the cell. If the cell membrane moves around, like for exocytosis or endocytosis, and the microtubules also form that spindle apparatus. So those microtubules act as a little monorail system for organelles to hop a ride and move around in the cell, or chromosomes, or sister chromatids, or whatever. So that's the job of the centrioles. Okay, so we talked about that. The interesting thing that I haven't mentioned so far, and I don't think you ran into this in anatomy, the tips of these chromatids right here are called telomeres. And every time a cell undergoes mitosis, some of those telomeres or those ends are lost. All right? And when a telomere is used up, the cell becomes what we call senescent. All right? And then the cell is destroyed through a process called apoptosis. So not every cell has an indefinite life span. Okay? Sometimes we could think of the chopping off of little segments off the telomere as like a molecular clock that defines what the overall lifespan of that cell line is. All right, and that clock ticks down every time the cell undergoes division, which is really handy. Maybe that's one way to control the formation of tumors and cancers in the body, right? Because cancers don't ever die. Well, sometimes maybe they regress spontaneously, and it might be due because there's still some telemetric control over some of those chromosomes, but generally speaking, right, those tumor cell just continues to grow and divide, grow and divide, grow and divide until it's the death of the individual. All right, so here is an interesting way that maybe tumors could be controlled. Okay. Okay, meiosis. Let's talk about meiosis a little bit. So mitosis produces what? Identical daughter cells. Meiosis is a little bit different process. And so I'm going to erase something on the board right over here. I'm going to erase the daughter cells. Okay. And instead of a parent cell right here, you could call it a parent cell. And it's got 46 chromosomes as well. In two groups, like this, there's on one, a chromosome number one, a number two, number three, all the way down to a number 23. These are all different. They have a different size and shape. They contain different kinds of information. And let's just say this is the maternal set, and then there's another number one, a two, three, all the way down to 23. So this number one is very similar to this one, but it contains a little bit different information because it comes from your dad, right? That's the paternal set. Number two is a lot different than number one, right? These two number ones are similar to each other. So if we're talking about the two number one chromosomes or the two number two, we call those homologous chromosomes. Okay, so let's just say M number three is homologous to what? P number three, right. But M number three is not homologous to P number two or P number one or M number two or M number one, right? So it's coming from the different set over here. Those are homologous chromosomes. And before this process starts, before meiosis starts, what has to happen. Just like mitosis, replication, DNA replication has to occur as well. Okay? So again, you have sister chromatids and you have homologous chromosomes, and what meiosis does, instead of breaking down into two cells, you get four cells. And in each one of those cells, you only get one set of chromosomes. You get a number one, a number two, all the way down to a 23. Same over here, here, and here. So there's only one set of chromosomes. Sometimes we call cells that have the full complement of chromosomes diploid, or 2N, because there's two copies of every chromosome inside the cell. The job of meiosis is to cut the chromosomes in half. Instead of 46, you end up with 23. And that we call haploid. Or another way of saying it is 1N. So meiosis is a nuclear reduction kind of reaction. It's much different than mitosis, which just produces clones over and over and over again. And the chromosomes that end up over here are just a random mixture of maternal and paternal chromosomes. So this one might have number 1P, number 2M, number 3M, and then a number 4P. It's just a flip of the coin which chromosomes end up in this cell over here. This cell right here is called a germ cell. Okay, that's a germ cell. Some people call it a stem cell, but that's really probably not quite correct. All right, and a germ cell, after it undergoes mitosis, produces these human cells right here, and they've got a name too. Anybody know what these guys are called? These are called gametes. So what's the ploidy of a gamete? What's the ploidy of a gamete? That's a weird kind of word, okay? But I have to use it on you so that you're familiar with it. What's the ploidy of this germ cell right here? It is diploid. That's the ploidy of this cell, okay? So it's not too difficult a language to pick up. So what's the ploidy of a gamete? It is haploid. It has half the number of chromosomes, or 1N. All right, so that's the job of meiosis, is to produce gametes, which are haploid cells. And what could a gamete look like? Could a gamete look like this? Absolutely. All right, so sperm is a gamete. What's another kind of gamete that some people produce instead of a sperm? Could be an egg. All right, so here's an egg. What's the ploidy of this egg right here? Haploid, or you say 23, right, chromosomes. This is true. All right, so we could take this sperm, and it could join this egg to produce this cell right here. So we take these 23 chromosomes, and what's the ploidy of this gamete right here? 23. So we, end up with 46, right? Again, two sets. One set from dad, one set from mom. So what's the ploidy of this cell? Right, that's a diploid cell right there. And what do we call this cell? That's got a name. That's a zygote. That's the zygote right there. All right, so like I said before, we were all a zygote at one point in time. All right, and then we got big. But I tell you what, when you take these two gametes, a sperm and an egg, I didn't write this down, sperm. All right, when a sperm and an egg join together to form a zygote, what do we call that process? Everybody knows. That's fertilization. Okay, fertilization. All right, so fertilization produces a zygote, and then a zygote, what does a zygote do? Produces that. What is that process called? What is this process? Going from one cell to trillions of cells, that's what? That's mitosis. Okay? So that's kind of the whole human life cycle right there. Okay, germ cells produce gametes. Gametes from different people come together to form a zygote, and that then defines a new human being. Okay, and what does the human being produce then? More gametes, right? All right, so that's like the human life cycle right there. All right, so I want to tell you a little bit more about mitosis, but now I think you see how it fits into everything. Yeah.
Gamete is a haploid.
Gamete is haploid. Yeah. Pretty much everywhere in the world that I know. Right, if you're a plant or a fungus or whatever, your gametes are always haploid. Okay. And so this process allows for sexual reproduction. Mitosis doesn't provide for sexual reproduction. Meiosis provides for sexual reproduction. Okay, well, and we get to sexual reproduction. What is the purpose of sexual reproduction? Okay, a lot of people say, well, to reproduce. Well, guess what? You're wrong. Okay, and you'll have to come to the last week of classes to find out what reproduction is all about. Okay. Okay, so what are some of the basics? You've got homologous chromosomes, and you got sister chromatids. So meiosis is a little bit different than mitosis because you need two rounds of separating things in order to produce gametes right here. So what are the two steps? Every step of separation goes by the same phases that you know for mitosis, which is what? Prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. But there are two rounds of that for mitosis. All right, so, I'm sorry, for meiosis, thank you so much, for meiosis. All right, so, here you see chromosomes, or chromatin condensed into chromosomes. All right, and so you see a little X right here, that is what? That's a replicated chromosome, and each one of those, that parts of an X is a sister chromatid. All right, so that's replicated, ready to undergo meiosis. So the first round of meiosis is what we call meiosis 1. That's characterized by prophase 1, metaphase 1, anaphase 1, telophase 1. Now what separates during the first round of meiosis? If we look at this, what do we have right here? All right, what's the best way to talk? What's the relationship between this chromosome and this chromosome? Okay, they are what we call... Those have the same shape and size. Those are what we call homologous chromosomes. The biggest chromosome is a number one, so that kind of looks like a number one chromosome to me. All right. Here's a number one chromosome. Maybe that's 1M. And then this would be 1P. Right? And it's been replicated. So what separates in the first round of meiosis are the homologous chromosomes. So here you see one coming over here and the other one coming over here to the other cell. Homologous chromosomes separate. And then cytokinesis takes place. Right? And you can still see that these chromosomes are what? Replicated. You still see sister chromatids right here. So the second round of meiosis separates the sister chromatids from each other. So that's kind of the level that I want you to understand meiosis. Right, that it has these two rounds of nuclear separation. The first one is separating the homologous chromosomes. The second round separates the sister chromatids. And then you end up with four, right? Well, daughter cells, but these are going to mature into gametes. Okay, and those gametes then have the function of fertilization, can fertilize. Okay, so that is meiosis, different than mitosis. So what is the difference between this daughter cell, or you could say gamete, compared to this initial parent cell, which you could call a germ cell? Are they exactly the same? Vastly different. It's missing half the chromosomes. Right, and this cell right here has half from the mom, half from the dad, And this one just has some random arrangements of one set of chromosomes. Sometimes it's the dad chromosome, sometimes it's the mom chromosome. And every time you look at a gamete, it's going to be different because it's always a flip of the coin which chromosome gets put into the cell. So all gametes are different from each other. And if you look around the room, what's similar, okay, compared to when you look around the room? If we say all gametes are different from each other and you look around the room, what do you see? Yeah, you see nobody looks the same, right? And so because these gametes are all different, that produces all different people, right? That's why brothers and sisters even look different, right? Right. Unless you're identical twins, then you look fairly similar, but there's even differences there.
On the first set of dividing, is that like a 1 through 46 and either get maternal or paternal?
Right.
The second time they're split.
Right. Then the sister chromatids for second round of meiosis. Right. Right, right, right. And of course, this means that everything has to work properly. Right, there are times when maybe this ends up with maybe two homologous chromosomes and this one over here is going to be missing one, and that's going to probably cause the death of those cells or the death of that zygote. Okay, so this is if everything goes correctly with meiosis. Not guaranteed to always happen perfectly. All right, so that's pretty much it for this particular chapter. That was a little fast, but you should be experts on mitosis already. You might have to go back and read a little bit about meiosis, but those are some of the salient features. So a good typical question would be, what separates during meiosis 1? It is the homologous chromosomes. What separates during meiosis 2? You would say, there's no such thing as meiosis 2. No, that would be the wrong answer. Okay. You would say, what separate? Because that's going to be a question, probably, right? Or say, none of the, you wouldn't select none of the above. You would say, during meiosis 2 is sister chromatids, right? Because before meiosis takes place, what has to happen? DNA replication. The DNA has to be replicated, okay, just like in mitosis. All right, okay, so let's go to... I think I have the next one here. Chapter 6. All right, so chapter 6 is interactions between cells and the extracellular environment. So we have to define what the extracellular environment is, I think, before we really get started. And just generally speaking, what's the extracellular environment mean? Everything outside the cells, yeah? And water. Water is a very important component of that. Okay, so these are all the things we're going to talk about in this chapter. The extracellular environment, movement across the plasma membrane, something about diffusion and osmosis, membrane transport, the membrane potential and cell signaling. And this word right here is kind of a loaded term, potential. Does anybody know what potential means? I'll have to tell you a number of times. This is a good place to start. Potential just means another name for potential right here is voltage. Okay? Yes, we're very electrical beings. You're going to be surprised on how electrical we are. All right? And so whenever you see this term potential, there might be some times we're not talking about voltage, but in most cases, we're going to be talking about a voltage. Okay. All right, so let's start with extracellular environment. So this includes all constituents of the body that lies outside of cells. Everything inside the cell is the intracellular environment. Okay? And the intracellular environment is about 67% of your total body. And it's water inside cells. Okay? Extracellular compartment, we're just going to call that the ECF for short, 33% is outside of cells. And again, that's going to be mostly water. 80% of the extracellular fluid is what we call interstitial fluid. And so that's water contained in a gel-like matrix of connective tissue, right? So it's like a spongy material that's made out of proteoglycans. It's a sugar protein kind of molecule. So protein has been conjugated with a sugar. What kind of organelle conjugates a protein with a sugar molecule? Say it out really loud. What organelle is made for modification of proteins?
A Golgi body.
That's right, a Golgi body will we'll take a protein and add a sugar molecule to it. Okay, 20% of the ECF is blood plasma, right? That's in your blood vessels. That's really not considered extra, that's not the interstitial space. The interstitial space is the space between cells. Plasma we find in the blood right here. So here we see some epithelium, that's tightly packed cells. But here is connective tissue, and here I see, for instance, maybe a fibroblast. And then where's the next cell at? Way over here. So all of this stuff right here is the, that's going to be the extracellular space, in particular the interstitial space, and that has those glycoproteins and proteoglycans in it that act like a sponge to hold water in this interstitial space between the cells. And the other compartment that is outside the cells that is fluid is what? This plasma right here that makes up blood vessels. And these are all kind of held together because there are fibers that go through the matrix like collagen and elastic fibers that attach to other kinds of proteins that go across the cell membrane, which we call integrins. And so that just holds all of the cells together, all of these different kinds of fibers, right? It holds tissues together. Okay. So the interstitial fluid of that extracellular fluid resides in a hydrated gel of ground substance. So all of this stuff right here, besides collagen, these thick fibers and the thinner fibers, there's ground substance that acts like a sponge to hold water. All right, so those are all the different fluids in the body. And things can move through fluid pretty easily. They can diffuse as long as they're water soluble. All right, now what about the plasma membrane? What can move across a plasma membrane? Okay. So you have to think. Just try to keep in your mind what the structure of the plasma membrane looks like. How would you, what is just a basic, simple description of plasma membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer. And the inner part of the cell membrane is what, hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic in nature, right? All right, so the plasma membrane is what we call selectively permeable. Another term we could use is semi-permeable. That means some things can move across the membrane from inside the cell to outside, but not everything. Okay, many important molecules have what we call transporters or channels to go across the membrane. And indeed, right, only lipid-soluble compounds can go across the cell membrane because that inner part of the cell membrane is what? Is lipid. So water can't go across, ions can't go across the cell membrane because of that lipid area between the phospholipid molecules. So if a hydrophilic molecule needs to move across the membrane, it needs help. It needs a carrier. We call, and if that's the case, then we call that carrier-mediated transport that involves a specific protein or transporter across the membrane. Or maybe there's got to be a tunnel or passageway through the membrane, and that's got to be a protein as well. So that would be, the process would be non-carrier-mediated transport that occurs by diffusion through membrane channels. That's going to be basically a nice protein hole through the membrane. All right, another way to think of membrane transport is that it can occur by two general kinds of processes. And the two most general kinds of processes would be passive transport versus active transport. And passive just means that compounds move down a concentration gradient, and passive really means requires no energy. So molecules can move from an area of high concentration to low. Active transport, on the other hand, means that a molecule can move from, okay, against the concentration gradient. That means from low concentration to high. It can become more concentrated, but when that happens, energy is required. So what is the form of energy inside your cells? ATP, right? So in order for active transport to take place, then ATP is required somewhere. So how are you going to remember always how that's going to work? Well, I know when I was in college, I didn't have a very good car. I had a 1976 MGB, and it was already like 20 years old. Okay, and the MGB is almost a little bit bigger than this tabletop right here. It was really, really small. It's a nice sports car. But it was not very reliable. Okay, well, it was fun to drive because it had a stick shift and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes after work or school, I'd go out and I'd turn the key and it would just go click, 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 click. So the battery was dead, right? Or a starter motor was rusted out on it. Okay, so I learned that if I wanted to go home after school, I had to park in a certain location. So where would I park my car? I would park my car right here. Because I knew that even if I didn't have the starter motor or the battery was dead, right, I could just put the car in neutral, start pushing it down the hill, and then as long as I was in first gear, pop the clutch, and that would turn the engine over, and that was really nice because then I could go home. All right, so if the car is parked on top of the hill, does it take any energy to roll down? Is that active or passive? That's passive. All right? That's passive. So passive is when even molecules go from high to low, right? So that's one way to remember that. Now, what about if my car is down over here? Will it just roll up the hill all by itself?
No.
No. That's what we call active. And in order for that car to go up the hill, it needs what?
ATP.
It needs ATP, for instance, if that car were us. It needs that energy in ATP. Most cars, of course, use gasoline, but let's just say ATP, think of that as a biological car. So active means when a molecule goes from low concentration to high concentration. It won't automatically happen, all right? But it will automatically happen going from high concentration to low. One process that is passive is called diffusion. So if I have a perfume bottle right here, and I open up the perfume bottle, that even though I don't have a fan blowing the perfume around in the room anywhere, that perfume is going to move from high concentration near the bottle or inside the bottle to first the front row, you're going to smell it, then the second row, then the third row, and then finally even all the way in the back. That perfume is just going to fill up the whole room with an even distribution. So what's moving that perfume is a concentration gradient. Okay. Well, before we start talking about this a little bit more, I want to make sure that we know some terminology. And that is, what is a solution? A solution has two components associated with it. Maybe you're familiar with this, maybe not. I'm not so sure. But a solution is part solvent and part solute. So the solvent is the liquid part of a solution, and the solute is the junk that's dissolved in it. All right? And so the major part of a solution is what we're going to call the solvent, and the minor component is going to be the solute. All right, so let's look at some of these questions. So what have you used as a solvent today? What have you used as a solvent?
Milk.
Okay, milk is actually what? A solution. Okay. All right, we'll work on that a little bit. But what is the major component of milk?
Coffee.
I like coffee is an excellent example of, all right, of a solution. So coffee and milk are kind of similar in that sense, because what did you use to make coffee?
Water.
Okay. So water. So what have you used as a solvent today? You have used
water
to make coffee. So if you only have water and you want coffee, what else do you need?
Sugar.
You need the coffee particles themselves. That's going to be the solute. You need coffee grounds or something, or some dehydrated coffee that's coffee without the water out of it. Then you mix them together, so you got the coffee and the water, right? The coffee beans and the water, and you end up with a solution of coffee. Or maybe you made tea or some other kinds of stuff, right? Or you could think of orange juice as a solution. The solvent is water. And then there are other compounds, like little orange molecules in there. That would be the solute, or the pulp, or whatever. Okay. In terms of milk, milk is a solution. The solvent would be water. And then the other components in milk would be the solutes, which would be calcium and lactose, and there's lipid in there as well. Those all would be the solutes. Okay. So a solution is solvent plus solute. And so what solutes have you used today? Some people said, coffee beans. Other people said, calcium and lipids and milk. Okay, what else? What else have people used as a solute today? Yeah, the orange molecules, that's good.
Snickers bar.
Snickers bar, that's a solid. Okay, so that's not really a solution.
Yeah,
and your body dissolved it very nicely. I like that. Okay. Well, what's a major component that makes Snickers bars so good? Okay, there's chocolate, there's sugar, right? So maybe some of you have made coffee today, which is a solution, and use water, and maybe you even use some sugar to put in that coffee, right? That would be a solute as well. Did anybody salt their coffee? Anybody put salt in their coffee? That's good. Okay, that would just produce hypertension. That wouldn't be good. So salt would be a solute. Okay. All right, now if you had Gatorade, for instance, and it might be like an orange drink, what's the solvent for Gatorade? It's water. What's the solute? It's an orange color. There's sugar in there. And there's even salt in there. There's electrolytes. There's salt. There's sodium and potassium in there too. So those are all minor components. Those would all be solutes. All right, so in your body, what's the major solvent in your body?
Water.
Your water. We saw that on the previous slide. What are some important solutes in your body? Yeah, there are proteins that are dissolved in liquid, all the electrolytes like sodium ions, potassium ions.
Did you say that the major solvent
was
blood or water?
Water. Water. Yeah, just water. Blood is a liquid. You know, it's a connective tissue. Plasma is mostly water, but plasma is a solution because plasma has water, which is a solvent, plus electrolytes, which would be the solute. Right? So I want you to break up in your mind what a solution really is. Make sure you can break it down into those compartments.
Glycogen,
that would be a solute. It's dissolved in water of your body. Now here's kind of a strange one. What's a minor solvent in your body? What's a minor? Most of your body is dissolved in water, but that's still water in there, but there's a small area in your body that is oil, okay, lipid. Where do you find that oil that things can dissolve in? Okay. Well, don't forget, every cell has that phospholipid bilayer, okay? And so here is a plasma membrane right here, and right here, and right here, and then you have a fatty acid sticking down, right? So this area here is the lipid environment. Things can live right in the center of the membrane. They can't live anywhere else as long as they're what? Hydrophobic. Okay? So that's like a whole nother world because it's a hydrophobic region of your body. Inside the cytoplasm and interstitial space, that's the hydrophilic realm of your body. And I think that might make more sense in a couple months. Okay. All right, so what last thing? What can dissolve in this minor solvent? Give an example. What can dissolve in here? Steroids can dissolve right in there. And we're going to see some other signaling compounds can dissolve in that area as well. Okay. All right, so the next slide right here, diffusion. Okay, diffusion is the result of some random motion of molecules. And all molecules have motion associated with them. And it depends on the temperature. As the temperature increases, the motion increases, right? So temperature and molecular motion are directly related to each other. And I think we talked about this, right? If we have water and we heat it up, the water molecules bounce around so much, and if we heat it up even more, they jump right out of solution. What do we call that? That's boiling, right? So temperature is just a measure of molecular motion. So things are always getting stirred up just because of molecular motion. And diffusion is the net movement of a region from high concentration to low, just like my car right here. So if we have a beaker, and these dots right here represent the solutes, right? And then just this background are just the water molecules. And there's a membrane right here. Then the solutes that are at high concentration, even though we don't mix this up at all, these molecules are going to move through the membrane as long as it's permeable to this solute. This solute is going to move into the right-hand side, right, by diffusion. And then when the concentration is the same, guess what happens? Then diffusion stops. So the greatest motive force for moving solute molecules around is a concentration gradient. And when that concentration gradient goes to zero, diffusion stops. So for instance, if I had that perfume bottle again right here, as soon as I open it up, that's when diffusion is the fastest. That's when the molecules move the fastest. And then if we let it sit there overnight and close the doors and come back in the morning, no matter where we go in the room, it's going to have the same concentration or perfume. What could you say about diffusion after a long period of time? It stops, right? Because the concentration gradient is the same. And it just doesn't go from diffusion to no diffusion. At the very beginning, it's the fastest. And as the concentration gradient starts to go away because diffusion is taking place, diffusion starts to slow down, and then eventually stop. All right, so that's a real important process in our body because that's how our body moves a lot of major components around. So for instance, our cells, we're going to learn a lot about this, our cells need oxygen to make ATP. What's the organelle?
Mitochondria.
Right? Mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. And then mitochondria makes ATP, and in the process, it produces CO2. All right, so how do these cells get oxygen? So oxygen is this blue little particle right here. It moves into these cells basically by diffusion. So where is oxygen high? Inside your body at the cells, or is it high out in the atmosphere? That's right. Because diffusion can only go from high concentration to low. All right, so if that's the only process where your cells can get oxygen is by diffusion, then oxygen has to be high in the atmosphere and low in your cells, otherwise it would not go in. All right, so it's a little counterintuitive. You have to think about that. Now, what about CO2? Where is it high? Is it high in your body or high in the atmosphere? It's high in your body, because if it wasn't high in your body, then it would never leave, right? If it was high in the atmosphere, where would CO2 go? It would go in your body, right? And you couldn't live if that was the case, right? And the concentration of CO2 in the air is almost zero. It's really close to zero. So there's a high concentration gradient, so it's easy for CO2 to leave your body because the concentration of CO2 is pretty close to zero everywhere. All right, so only nonpolar compounds readily diffuse through the cell membrane. Why is that? Nonpolar compounds, because of that nonpolar region in the center of the membrane. Oxygen and CO2 are that way. They can diffuse through the membrane. Okay. Now, what if there was a polar molecule? Right, because cell membranes are impermeable to charged and most polar compounds. What's your most favorite polar kind of compound? Which has a lot of polar covalent bonds on it?
Carbon.
Carbon is just the backbone of organic molecules. How about glucose? What does glucose have? It's got a lot of carbons. And what's on either side of this carbon? OH or an H, right? So this is a nice polar covalent bond. So sugars are highly polar. That's why when you put sugar in coffee or tea, what does it do? Dissolves right away. All right? But can that polar compound go through this nonpolar area of the plasma membrane? Sugars are excluded. They can't get through the plasma membrane because of that. All right? But those cells need glucose, otherwise they're going to die. Okay, so charged molecules must have an ion channel or a transporter to cross the membrane because they can't get through this nonpolar region right here. So let's just say an ion, like sodium, it has a charge, it's highly polar, it just can't diffuse through this region right here. There's got to be a channel whereby sodium or potassium or other electrolytes can go from outside to inside the cell. And cells will regulate that channel. Some channels remain open all the time, others sometimes are closed, and at other times open. So that means cells can regulate the transit of ions from outside to inside or inside to outside. So that's the beauty of these transporters right here. But if it's just a channel, ions can only go in one direction, passively. What's the direction an ion can move? Only from high concentration to low. That's right. Because, do you see any ATP on this slide right here? no energy source. So the driving force is that concentration gradient. All right, there's got to be a concentration gradient for that to happen. All right, so diffusion is dependent on or related to these various factors right here. The rate of diffusion is directly related to the concentration gradient. If the concentration gradient is big, the rate is fast. If the concentration gradient is small or goes away, what happens to the rate of diffusion? Slows down and stops, right? So that's the first thing to remember. Second thing, the permeability of the membrane, right? If a solute or water is going to move across a membrane, it's got to have some way to get across. Not all membranes are permeable to water or to solutes, right? And temperature. Diffusion is directly related to temperature. So as temperature increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases as well because it's directly related. And then the last thing is the surface area of the membrane. If it's a big, super big membrane, like as big as this wall right here, a lot of things can diffuse through it. But if it's a tiny, tiny membrane, then the doorway is small. Remember, when I say surface area, what's the everyday word you should think of? Did I show you? Yeah, I showed you over here, doorway. Right, as the doorway gets bigger, more molecules can cross it. And that's just due to the surface area. And there's one factor that's inversely related to the rate of diffusion, and that is the size of the particle. As the size of the particle increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion if it's inversely related? It goes down. So think of two vehicles stopped at a stoplight. One is my motorcycle, and another is a big semi-tractor trailer carrying a load of cars or something, and the light turns green. Guess who's going to get through the intersection first? Okay, no doubt I will on my motorcycle because it's smaller, right? It accelerates a lot faster compared to this big, huge bus or semi-tractor trailer. So think of molecular weight as the size of the molecule. And maybe you did an experiment. Did you do an experiment in lab already on molecular weight and diffusion? I think so. So this is just kind of a recapitulation of what you did in lab. All right, so that's diffusion. Diffusion is passive, only from high concentration to low, and it can be adjusted depending on temperature, molecular weight, concentration gradient, right? And then to get through the membrane has to be permeable to it. So that means only hydrophobic molecules can move across the membrane because of this hydrophobic region right here. All right, biologically, there is an important process that we call osmosis. And osmosis is a special kind of diffusion. If there is a special kind of diffusion that can meet all three criteria, then it is osmosis. Otherwise, it's just simple diffusion. So I'm going to describe some things about osmosis right now. So what I have, what are the three necessary criteria for a process to be considered osmosis? Okay, well, let's look at this slide right here. What do we see right here? So osmosis is the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. All right, so that kind of says it all. All right, so if it's a diffusion, what does that mean? Water moves down its concentration gradient. It means it goes from high to low. What about energy? Does it require energy?
No
energy. Okay, because that's diffusion. All right, so water moves, is less concentrated, where there are more solute molecules. All right, so the higher the solute concentration, the less water there is in that particular beaker. All right, and the solutes have to be osmotically active. What the heck does that mean? Let's look at this membrane right here. See the pores in the membrane? Water is small enough to move through these pores, but these solute molecules are too big to move across. They won't fit through this little pore right here because they're too big. So this membrane right here is what we call selectively permeable. It lets water through, but not everything. Another term is semi-permeable. Selectively permeable and semi-permeable are the same thing. And because it's a semi-permeable membrane, we say that these particles are osmotically active. All right, so we start at 3. You know what? I got to take a break. And then I'll be right back in 3 minutes. So somebody ask a question and answer it. But you can't leave. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Is that still going around? Okay, don't go anywhere. Who's got that sign-in sheet? Okay, yeah, just pass it down to the front. Hi. I'm in the middle of a lecture, pardon me. Okay, so let's continue on with, thank you so much, osmosis. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? All right, let's look at the next slide. Yeah, absolutely.
On the previous slide there, where it says water is less concentrated where there are more solutes.
Yeah.
That just means there's less water because there's more solutes.
Yeah. Exactly right. So the water is this blue right here. On the right-hand side, we have more solutes. We have fewer blue molecules. But on the left-hand side, there are fewer solutes, so we see more water.
So the water is always going to go to the side where there's more solutes?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it is. Because here is a high concentration of water. Here is a low concentration of water. So water will move by diffusion through this membrane right over here, always going from high concentration to low. Okay, and the reason why water moves but not the solute is because the solute can't get through the membrane for whatever reason. Maybe it's too big. Can't get through these pores. Okay. All right, so for osmosis, water has to diffuse down its concentration gradient. Let's take a look at this experimental setup over here. So here's a cube, and we're going to cut the cube in half. And let's just say the volume on the left-hand side and the right-hand side is the same. It's equal to X. That's just the volume. And in between these two volumes is a semi-permeable membrane. It's going to allow water to go through, but not solutes. And remember, water is the solvent in this system. So we have a solution here and a solution right over here. Okay, and these dark dots actually represent the solute molecule, like the salt or glucose or something like that. And since this, oh, it's glucose in this particular case. And let's make the glucose more concentrated on the right-hand side, twice the concentration in terms of grams per liter. So we have 360 grams per liter on the right-hand side, 180 grams per liter of glucose on the left. So which side is more concentrated in water?
The left.
The left, because that's where the solute is the lowest, right? So when you see a question about diffusion, always figure out if they're talking about the solvent molecule concentration or the solute molecule concentration, because otherwise you'll get it right, but exactly backwards. So that wouldn't be good. Okay, I don't ask tricky questions like that, but you'll probably have board exams like that. All right, so water, which way is water going to want to diffuse? From high concentration to low concentration. Okay, now the solute right here can't get through the membrane. And since it can't get through the membrane, this membrane is called a selectively or semi-permeable membrane. Only water can move through. So water is going to go from high to low, And when it does that, this membrane is going to shift positions until the concentration of water in both chambers is exactly equal. Okay, so it's going to move that membrane. So now we have the same concentration of glucose on either side of this membrane because water diffused across it. All right, so it got now 270 grams per liter on the right and 270 on the left, and vice versa. Okay. All right, so some membranes, for instance, water usually can't diffuse across a membrane because it can't get through this lipid layer right here, but cells have special channels for water to move across, and those are called aquaporins. And some cells regulate how many aquaporins are in this membrane depending on the needs of the body or for those particular cells. Okay. So osmotic pressure is another term. It's a force, right? A pressure is a force. So that's the force that you would have to exert on this system that we established right here to stop osmosis, right? Because water wants to move from left to right, increasing the volume of this chamber over here, but we can stop that by pushing this membrane in. And the amount of pressure to counteract the pressure of water as it's flowing into this chamber right here is what we call the osmotic pressure. So that indicates how strongly water wants to diffuse through this membrane, and it's proportional to the solute concentration that's over here. All right, so here we just have pure water. Water is going to want to go from high concentration to low concentration. It's low because of all the solute particles. Okay, so that's what we call osmotic pressure. Maybe I'm going to come back to this slide in just a little bit. Yeah, let me talk about this one right now. Well, I tell you what, let's just think of this for a second. Instead of a beaker or a chamber, you could actually think of these as being cells. All right, maybe here's a cell with a certain solute concentration. If we put this cell in a pure water solution, that water is going to rush into the cell. What's going to happen to the size of that cell or the shape? It's going to get bigger, right? And get bigger and get bigger. Okay. All right. Well, let's now define how we can talk about how salty a solution is or how concentrated a solution is. There are two different ways we talk about it. One way in terms of molarity and another way in terms of molality. And what the heck does that mean? Okay, a one molar solution with a capital M right here is when we take one mole of solute. So what would be a good, what's a solute in this particular case? It is glucose, right? I have glucose right here. You could, yeah, salt could be a good example, but specifically I'm not using it in this example. And one mole is equal to 180 grams of it. And the reason why that is, okay, because one mole of something is equal to 6 point blah, 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 times 10 to the third, 23rd particles makes a mole of something. And in order to get this 180 grams, we know that glucose has, well, how many carbon atoms? It's got 6, and then you would look at the periodic table over here to find the weight of carbon, right? It's got 6 carbons, that's because that's the, I mean, 6 protons, but it also has about 6 neutrons in it, so the molecular, the atomic mass is 12, so we multiply 6 because glucose has 6 carbons times 12, but what else would we have to add? We'd have to add the number of oxygens in there and the number of hydrogens, and if you add all those numbers together in the right proportion, you get 180 grams per mole. Right, and if we take that 180 grams, measure it precisely, and put that in this beaker right here and fill this beaker up to exactly this 1 liter mark, that would be a one molar solution of glucose because you put one mole of particles in there, right, and you fill it exactly to the 1 liter mark. That's molarity. All right, well, there's another way and a better way of measuring the concentration of glucose for biological systems. And that's using this term right here, molality. And molality is a little bit different. You still start with one mole of glucose, which is equal to 180 grams. You put it in the beaker. But now you don't fill the beaker up exactly to the 1 liter mark. You put in exactly 1 liter of water. So if you put in 1 liter of water, plus you have a mole of glucose, can you see that this beaker gets filled past the 1 liter mark? Okay, because this glucose takes up a certain amount of volume right here. Okay, so this is what we call molality. And this is what we like to use for biological systems, because sometimes when we make up a solution, sometimes the molecules are really big, like glucose, and sometimes the molecules are really small, like sodium, for instance. And if we make up a 1 molar solution, then the number of particles per ml, milliliter, or liter is going to be a lot different compared to if we use a big molecule. So if we use molality, we know exactly the proportion of the solute molecule compared to the solvent molecule. Right? So it's always going to be the same if you use the molal mixing method right here. Right? So with the molality, we take the right amount of solute and the exact amount of solvent, put them together, and we know exactly what the ratio is from solvent to solvent. We don't know what that is with a molar solution because it depends on the size of the molecule that we're using for the solute. So you get mixed up. Okay. Okay. One last term. All right, and that is osmolality. So these properties of osmosis that we've been talking about have only to do with the concentration of particles that are in solution. All right, and some molecules we know, when we put them in solution, they break apart. They break into maybe 2 particles or 3 particles. So for instance, if we take sodium chloride, all right, add glucose in the left-hand side of this beaker, we put glucose. Glucose doesn't break apart into 2 different compounds. It just dissolves into solution. Right? So it's going to be a 1 molal solution of glucose. Right? So if we take this beaker right here and put it in water right here, it's still going to be a 1 molal solution. But if we put sodium and chloride in solution, what happens to sodium and chloride when we put it in water? It breaks apart. So now we have twice the number of particles in solution, and that's going to change how osmosis takes place. And so instead of this is a 1 molal solution of NaCl, but when it dissociates, right, we have to use this osmolality to take into account that you have 2 particles. All right, so on the left-hand side, this is a 1 osmolar solution, and on the right, this is a 2 osmolar solution, even though you started with the same concentration of particles because the sodium chloride breaks into 2. All right, and when you do, and if this is a water can move across the membrane, but sodium and chloride can't, and glucose can't, guess which way water is going to diffuse? It's going to go from left to right, and it's going to move this membrane over. All right, if sodium chloride couldn't dissociate, let's do this experiment. If sodium and chloride can't dissociate, what's going to happen to the diffusion of water right here? It's going to stay the same, right? But since this sodium chloride breaks apart, you have twice the number of particles. Water is less concentrated over here, higher concentration on the left. Water will diffuse from left to right, and it's going to move this membrane over. Let me see what this next slide is. Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay, so tonicity, you know what, we're at a place right now to where I think I can talk about osmosis, what that really means a little bit more, okay? All right, so again, think about what makes up a solution. Let's go back a whole bunch of slides. I don't want to flip through all those slides. It's solvent and solute, okay? So in order for something to be diffusion, it just means that anything can move from high concentration to low. It could be a gas molecule. It could be a solvent molecule. It could be a solute molecule. No big difference. But for osmosis, okay, the molecule that has to be diffusing, okay, is water, is the solvent molecule. So for osmosis, the first thing is that it's got to be diffusion. Okay, the first criteria is diffusion, which means what? It's kind of a loaded term. Diffusion is high to low. What about energy?
No
energy. Does it require? So it's passive, right? So osmosis is passive, which means things can only go from high concentration to low. That's the first one. The second criteria is that it can only be the solvent molecule. No solutes. I could say something interesting about that, but let's finish osmosis first. Okay, only the solvent molecule. What's the solvent in biology?
Water.
Water, right? You might find osmosis in other kinds of systems, not biological systems, but in an organic chemistry lab, you could talk about osmosis. Maybe it's some kind of polar solvent. But for biology, it's water. And the third criteria is that it has to go across a membrane, and the membrane has to be special.
Selectively permeable,
right? So in order for something to qualify for osmosis, it's got to be diffusion. Don't forget, that's a loaded term. It's got to be the water molecule for biology, and it's got to go across a semi-permeable membrane. Those are the three criteria. Okay. So that's osmosis. All right. I'll just tell you this real quick. Probably some of you have heard what dialysis means. Right, or at least heard what dialysis is. All right, so what is a solution again? Solution is solvent plus solute. All right, oh, there goes my car. Okay, so osmosis has to do with solvent molecule going across a selectively permeable membrane by diffusion. Dialysis is not the solvent molecule, but the solute molecule going across a selectively permeable membrane. So that's what we use in hospitals to get rid of what from somebody's body? Water? No? Nope, not water, but solutes like what? Excess sodium chloride, urea, for instance. Urea is toxic. All right, so dialysis is used as the same kind of process that we looked at for osmosis, but it's the solute molecule, not the solvent molecule.
But when they do dialysis, it's removing fluid.
Nope. It can be used, but dialysis strictly is the removal of solutes from a person's body. Okay? And hopefully somebody isn't so sick that we have to readjust the fluid levels as well, or the water. Best thing is just to get the solutes out without messing up somebody's water balance. So it's just the toxic compounds, the toxic solutes that are in somebody's body. Okay? Okay. Okay, so tonicity. All right? Remember, that membrane is going to move. It's going to exert pressure on the cell membrane. So there are forces that are exerted on the cell membrane. And so let's talk about tonicity. Tonicity is the effect of a solution on the osmotic pressure or the osmotic movement of water across the membrane. An isotonic solution has the same osmotic pressure. So if something is isotonic, what's going to happen to the membrane? Is it going to move one way or the other? It's going to stay in the same place. Okay. Hypertonic solutions have a higher osmotic pressure, all right, which means that they're going to compress a cell. They have a higher pressure. And a hypotonic solution has a lower pressure. So the cell is going to expand because the solution isn't exerting such a high pressure on that cell. All right, so let's look at this example right here. And I could draw this on the board if need be, but let's just take a look at this. Anybody recognize this cell right here? That's a red blood cell. And it should be nice and round, maybe a little dimple in the middle right here. Okay. And you know what? I'm going to draw this on the board. Then we can maybe call it a day. All right, so don't forget this high to low motion, passive, and all this kind of stuff. All right, so you're going to have to copy this down. So here is, let's draw three beakers. Here's a nice red blood cell. And in all cells of the body, you have about 0.9% NaCl. And when I say NaCl, I mean all the solutes inside the cell add up to about 0.9%. So what's the remainder?
Water.
And what, so we have H2O. What is the percentage of water inside the cell then? 99.1%. Yeah, 99.1%. Okay. And if we put this cell in, that red blood cell, in pure water, 100% water, no solutes, and salt cannot get through the membrane. So here is what? What kind of membrane is that? Semi-permeable membrane. But water can. Which way is water going to go? Water is going to move by diffusion from High to low. What's higher, 100% or 99.1? 100%. It doesn't look like there's that big a difference, but that's a huge difference to this measly little cell with this little dainty plasma membrane right here. So water's going to go in. What's going to happen to the shape of that cell? It's going to swell up, and as a matter of fact, that concentration is so huge that, and there's so much osmotic pressure that that cell is going to explode. Okay, it's going to hemolyze. See, it's just going to go all over. All right, so when that cell explodes, right, you just got little fragments of the plasma membrane everywhere. That's what we call hemolysis. That's hemolysis. Lysis is what? Breaking a cell down, hemo, because it's a blood cell. And the solution that causes hemolysis is what we call a hypotonic. Lower, right? There's less pressure pushing in on the cell membrane. It expands because water is going in. That's a hypotonic solution. That's a hypotonic solution. Let's look at a second case right here. All right, so inside the cell, 0.9% salt, 99.1% H2O. Salt can't get through the membrane, water can. Now let's put this in an isotonic solution. Isotonic means that it is the same mixture as what's inside the cell. All right, so if we got 0.9% salt, we have 99.1% water, H2O in this beaker. And which way is water going to go? It's always going to diffuse from high to low. It's going to go from high to low. So you look at this and say, what's higher, 99.1 or 99.1? 99.1. That's the same, right? So the amount of water leaving has got to equal the amount that's going in, which means what? Zero net transfer of water. What's going to happen to the shape of this cell? It's going to stay the same, right? Stay the same. This is what we call isotonic solution. And then let's do our third case over here. Don't forget, inside the cell, 0.9%, 99.1, H2O. And let's put this in ocean water. Anybody know what the concentration of salt in ocean water is? I always forget to look it up before class. It's not quite 5%, but let's say 5% salt. Just for fun, because I can do that math. 5% salt. So how much is water then? 95% water. Which way is water going to go? From high to low. What's higher, 99 or 95? 99.1. So water is going to leave this cell. And when it does, it's going to shrivel up. That cell, we say, is crenated, or the process of the cell shriveling up because there's higher pressure outside the cell. We call that crenation. And the solution that crenates a cell is what? Has more pressure on the outside because it's causing the cell to shrivel up, is what? Hypertonic solution. All right, so when you give an IV to somebody, or an injection, especially IVs, if you're injecting drugs directly into their circulatory system, what kind of solution do you think would be good to use? Or doesn't it really matter? Okay. Well, for me, it would matter, okay? Because I don't want to hemolyze these cells by giving a hypotonic solution. I wouldn't want my cells to crenate by giving a hypertonic solution. I would want a isotonic solution of IV, all right, so that my cells neither crenate or hemolyze. All right, so how are you going to remember? Before you go, I got a minute. All right, and no disaster drill, so that was really great. How are you going to remember? Hypertonic causes crenation. Hypotonic causes hemolysis. You know what? Go ahead. Even if I don't give this lecture in 50 years, I can always remember this. It's a really, as long as you don't tell anybody where you learned it from, I'll tell you. Here's a nice O in hypotonic, here's an O in hemolysis. Here is an E in hypertonic, here's an E in crenation. All right? You should understand the mechanisms of what's happening here, but if you're caught short on thinking and you got to answer a question really quick, just kind of remember that rule. right? But you should you should definitely know how it goes. So did everybody sign the sign-in sheet? Guess where you are if you don't sign the sign-in sheet? You're not in class if you don't sign this sign-in sheet, right? So here is, make sure you sign, please.